Chapter 9. The Globalists Try to Find the Narrative. Schwab and his Davos buddies keep trying to come up with a storyline that motivates people more than the classical idea that individuals struggle to lead a virtuous life, and in that effort, society has benefited. It seems as if they believe their failure to move people is because they just haven't come up with that magical myth that the idiots will blindly follow. Schwab first tried to pitch the Fourth Industrial Revolution, but it didn't catch fire. When that failed, he released the book Shaping the Future of the Fourth Industrial Revolution, maybe because, like a tourist in a foreign country, he believes that if he just speaks slowly and loudly, he can get the locals to understand him. Next, he tried COVID-19, the Great Reset. That was also a clunker. Maybe it struck people as a little insensitive for Schwab to say, in effect, "Hey, I know there was a global pandemic that killed millions of people, but let's look at this as an opportunity." Maybe, instead of being so provocative, he wanted to try for an exceptionally boring title. So his next effort, published in January 2021, was Stakeholder Capitalism, a Global Economy that Works for Progress, People, and the Planet. Let's take a closer look at this effort, co-written with Peter Vanham, who is head of Chairman's Klaus Schwab Communications at the World Economic Forum. In other words, he just happened to be in the office, so to speak. It must be so difficult for Klaus Schwab to have all of these important people praising his book, only to have the regular people treat you like an embarrassing uncle. This is from Mark Benioff, chair and CEO of Salesforce. 50 years ago, Klaus Schwab first proposed his theory that businesses are not only responsible to their shareholders, but also to all their stakeholders. With a global economic system generating deep divisions and inequalities, Klaus renews his call for a form of capitalism that works for everyone and where businesses don't just take from society, but truly give back and have a positive impact. Stakeholder capitalism is an urgent call to action. Mark Benioff would have you believe that before Klaus Schwab, nobody had ever raised the idea that businesses should be concerned with humanity. What kind of childhood did Benioff have? Did his parents never allow him to watch one of the many film adaptations of A Christmas Carol around the holidays? Has he never seen the ghost of Jacob Marley scream at Ebenezer Scrooge that instead of being a good man of business, mankind was my business? Has Mark Benioff never heard of charity? Schwab moves on to the praise from his next good friend, Alexander De Croo, the Prime Minister of Belgium, who wrote, "If you think this is just another pre-COVID, post-COVID book, think again. Klaus Schwab draws on his vast experience to take us on a roller coaster ride past the highs and lows of post-war capitalism. His knack for economic storytelling gives you a real and deep insight into where we are headed and what we should be aiming for." Yes, I'm sure the general public has been thinking to themselves, "I've read so many pre- and post-COVID books and how the world is going to change by so many dictators who want to rule humanity. What is this one going to say that's new?" Unfortunately, it seems that the politicians in every country have to start off by saying the stupidest possible thing. The Prime Minister of the Netherlands, Mark Rutte, doesn't fare much better. This is his contribution. In Stakeholder Capitalism, my good friend, Professor Schwab, outlines an inspiring way forward in making the global economy more equitable, sustainable, and future-proof. A vision that fits in perfectly with all his efforts over the years to build a better world. Once again, Professor Schwab gives us food for thought and reflection with this fascinating book. I find myself a little confused by the pronouncement of the Prime Minister of the Netherlands. How exactly is Schwab going to make the global economy future-proof? Does that mean no dissent will be allowed? No disruptive technologies will be released to the public? Is it just me? Or does it seem like the globalists don't like any future they don't control? In the preface, Schwab supports my premise that whether it was before COVID or after COVID, the Davos crowd has always been about globalism and tighter control over the world population. Schwab writes, "But now, we have some distance from the initial crisis, and many of us, including myself, have come to realize the pandemic and its effects are deeply linked to problems we had already identified with the existing global economic system. This perspective brought me back to the discussion I had been having in February 2020 on the date of that fateful call from Beijing. Many of the analyses we had previously been working on were more true than ever. You'll be able to read about them in this book." Don't you just love the intellectual openness of your typical globalist? He might as well have written, "I thought I was right before the pandemic, but now I know I'm even more right." No pause, no reflection, no criticism of anything that went on with any government anywhere in the world. Of course, those evil individual people will come in for strong criticism on account of not being collaborative and cooperative. But all those governments, they're just good and pure like fresh rainwater from the sky. And would it be a Klaus Schwab book without unfailing praise for the brutality of the Chinese Communist Party? Under the leadership of Chairman Mao from 1949 to 1975, the Communist Party of China, CPC, became the lone governing party of the country, ending the political turmoil more decidedly. The CPC founded the People's Republic of China as a single-party state, which brought stability to the regime for the price of democratic freedom. Democratic freedom, is that just a quaint little concept, like chocolate bunnies at Easter? Or could it possibly be more important, an ideal for which people have fought and died over the centuries? Schwab spends no time on the concept, only noting how during the time of Chairman Mao, China did not experience much economic progress. Instead, it was Mao's successor, Deng Xiaoping, who pursued increased economic progress while the state maintained an iron grip on power. Schwab wrote, "Deng wanted to change that, and in 1978 he visited Singapore. At the time, the island city-state was one of the four so-called Asian tigers, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore, and South Korea. Economies based on foreign direct investments, FDI, the shielding of key industries from foreign competition, and export-led growth. Having been inspired by the city-state's example, he pursued a new economic development model for China as well, the reform and opening up, starting in 1979. Let's be honest about some of our terms. What's meant by the shielding of key industries from foreign competition? That's protectionism, plain and simple. When we talk about foreign direct investment, what we mean is international money men who are not interested in local conditions, just the amount of profit they can make. And how can a government promise these international financiers the maximum amount of profit? By having a one-party government, which is essentially what all of these so-called Asian tigers were and remained at this writing. This is what Schwab himself wrote of Singapore. "In addition, Singapore's electoral model is very different from that of many other democracies. The ruling People's Action Party has led single-party governments continuously since Singapore's independence in 1965. Other parties do participate in the country's general elections, organized every 5 years, and in 2020, even won close to 40% of the vote. But these opposition parties have failed so far to win a significant number of seats or lead major government ministries. As a result, Nikkei Asian Review reported, Singapore ranked 75th in the Economist Intelligence Unit's Global Democracy Index for 2019, behind regional peers Malaysia, 43rd, Indonesia, 64th, and Thailand, 68th. The city-state performed especially poorly in the category of electoral process and pluralism." Schwab does his usual analysis, mentioning a glaring flaw such as the fact an opposition party has not won an election in 57 years in Singapore, then just moves on. The model Schwab loves is a simple one. The power of the state is combined with the power of big business, and the people are left without a voice. Tyrants always believe they are the smartest person in every room they occupy. For Schwab, elections just seem to be a formality. He'll work with those who got to their positions of power through the ballot or the bullet. The important thing is that the leaders do his bidding. But in Schwab's formulation of the world, there is no doubt it's the corporations who should be in charge. To avoid the worst and achieve the best possible outcome, all stakeholders should remember the lessons from the past, and governments should shape inclusive policies and business practices. The challenge in regulating technological breakthrough is often the speed of innovation. As a frustrated chief executive once expressed to me, business moves in an elevator lifted by the force of creativity. Governments and regulatory agencies take the stairs of incremental learning. This situation poses a particular responsibility to companies in ensuring that all technological advances are well understood, not only in terms of their functionality for individual users, but also what they mean for society more broadly. Schwab seems to treat the government like some elderly parent who must occasionally be instructed what's proper to say these days and what should not be said. In Schwab's view of the world, all honor and glory must go to the business person or entrepreneur with little, if any, consideration of the value of oversight. And as for the public, well, the entrepreneur must make sure to talk to them like scared children who, for some reason, have an irrational fear of their latest offerings. But sometimes the best spokesperson for the globalist might be an actual child, like Greta Thunberg. At the time she burst onto the world stage and the stage at the World Economic Forum, she was only 16 years old. I wonder if she realizes the incongruity of her being allowed to lecture on such a stage to the wealthiest people in the world that they have not done enough. Hopefully, at some point, as she gains a few more years and some more life experience, she will more deeply question the motives of those who promoted her on their various platforms. Schwab quotes with approval part of Thunberg's speech from the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland in January 2019. At places like Davos, people like to tell success stories. But their financial success has come with an unthinkable price tag. And on climate change, we have to acknowledge that we have failed. All political movements in their present form have done so. And the media has failed to create broad public awareness. Schwab was quite clear in 2022 that he didn't want any dissent at his World Economic Forum. So, how is it that he's promoting this young woman on his stage to criticize every member of the Davos gathering? My answer is because it serves the goals of Klaus Schwab. In order to take power, Schwab and his globalists need everything be torn down. Thunberg wants to tear things down as well, so it serves his ends. Schwab continued. Thunberg had become known for her school strike for climate a few months earlier, shaking up the debate about what has become known as the global climate crisis. In Davos, she used the platform to give the world a hard wake-up call on the actions needed to avert catastrophe. Adults keep saying we owe it to the young people to give them hope, she said at a special press conference. But I don't want your hope. I don't want you to be hopeful. I want you to panic. I want you to feel the fear I feel every day. And then I want you to act. I want you to act as you would in a crisis. I want you to act as if your house is on fire, because it is. We all remember what it was like to be young and filled with moral righteousness. But as we matured, we started to have a greater understanding of the complexity of the world. We came to understand that the best decisions are not made from a place of panic, but from calm, rational consideration. If you were trapped in a burning house, would you want the fireman coming to rescue you to be filled with panic? Or would you want a fireman completely aware of the danger, methodically plotting out the best route to safety through the flames? Schwab then moves on from provoking you into a state of panic to hoping you follow his rash suggestions. In his section on the key tasks of national governments, Schwab lays it out. At its simplest, the government's main role in the stakeholder model is to enable equitable prosperity. That means a government should enable any individual actor to maximize his or her prosperity, but do so in a way that is equitable for both people and the planet. It should do so in three primary ways. First, a government should value the contributions everybody makes to society, provide equal opportunities to all, and curb any excessive inequalities as they arise. Second, it should act as an arbiter and regulator for companies operating in the free market. And third, as a guardian of future generations, it should put a stop to activities that degrade the environment. Let's consider all the various things wrong with Schwab's modest proposal. He seeks to change the fundamental role of government from that of protecting the rights of individuals to live as they see fit to this new goal of equitable prosperity. I'm absolutely terrified of vague expressions like equitable prosperity because they can so easily be used to justify acts of injustice. Let's say we got two kids on a baseball team, but one of them can't hit a ball to save his life while the other keeps hitting home runs. Is it equitable to let one of the kids have a career in professional baseball while the other needs to pursue a different career like accounting? This is comforting pabulum used to lull the public into not fully understanding the massive grab of power the globalists intend to pursue. Here's an example. The government should value the contributions everybody makes to society. Does that include drug dealers, murderers, war profiteers, and child molesters? In Schwab's formulation, the government at this point, no doubt stacked with globalists, will act as an arbiter and regulator for companies operating in the free market. Do you see how the government has just usurped the role of the justice system in Schwab's plan? And you can be certain that if the globalists are acting as regulators of the economy, there will be no free market, just crony capitalism and monopolies for their favorite friends. Finally, Schwab claims the government role as a guardian of future generations in order to protect the environment. Now, I consider myself an environmentalist, not wanting people to spray chemicals that cause the frogs to, well, behave in unusual ways or have people eat genetically modified foods that I believe will negatively impact their health. But I'll detail for you exactly what I believe is wrong and what needs to be done to fix it. What I won't do is proclaim some universal right for the government to do anything it damn well pleases if it justifies it on the basis of environmentalism. This is the way tyrants take power. They don't tell you they want to steal your rights. They tell you that if you just give them the power, they will make it all better. But don't listen to them. Making the world a better place, whatever you believe that to be, is your job. Why is it that I remain so optimistic about our ability to defeat the globalists? It's because they can't tell a story to save their lives, and stories run the world. They fail to realize stories of freedom, of humanity's ability to triumph over great odds, are always more popular than stories of slavery or eternally young cyborgs, sexless and non-breeding. We are aware of what's wrong in the world. We want our stories to tell us how we, as individuals, can become heroes and make use of our limited time on this planet. Nothing proclaims the absolute failure of the globalists to say anything that the common people would support more than the publication on December 28, 2021 of Schwab's latest book, co-written with Thierry Mallaret, The Great Narrative for a Better Future. As Schwab himself wrote in the introduction, "As the most effective of conduits for ideas, narratives have the unique power to help us determine what's going on, what lies ahead, and what needs to be done," hence the title of this book. Defined in the simplest possible terms, a narrative is a story about something. More aptly, for the purpose of the great narrative, it is also a way of presenting or understanding a situation or events that reflects and promotes a particular view or set of values. The problem that Schwab never seems to consider is whether the narrative is true. What follows is Schwab's choosing of experts who reflect his point of view that the increasing complexity of the world requires greater authoritarian power, whether in direct government action or social shaming. But he never stops to consider the fundamental lie at the heart of his narrative. The lie is that the individual cannot be trusted to make their own decisions. It's a lie they'll never be able to sell, no matter how many experts they get, to tell you that you can't be trusted with the choices for your life. Recently, Hollywood was rocked by the unexpected success of a movie that few expected to be so wildly popular. The star was recreating a role that he'd first played 35 years earlier. It dealt with genuine military heroism, and there was nothing remotely woke about it. I am speaking, of course, of Tom Cruise's movie Top Gun Maverick, in which he portrays Pete Maverick Mitchell. What the globalists don't seem to understand is that a narrative can be fictional and yet reveal an underlying truth about humanity. We cheer not for the escape from almost certain death, but because it renews our belief in humanity's potential for greatness. The first scene sets the stage for the story that follows. Maverick is the test pilot for a futuristic jet called Dark Star, but the program is slated to be canceled in favor of unmanned drones. The essential conflict is set. Man v. the machine. Dark Star is set for a test flight that day, at which point it's supposed to go to Mach 9, which would be a world record. Eventually, the plane is expected to reach Mach 10. But the flight has been canceled by the general, wonderfully played by Ed Harris. Maverick talks with the flight crew, who all know their jobs are about to be canceled along with the project. Maverick decides to take the jet up because if he reaches Mach 9, the program must continue as per the contract. At this point, Maverick is fighting for the jobs of his friends. Maverick takes off just as the general arrives and quickly climbs to the required altitude, all while the general is cursing out the flight crew. But the general can't do anything because Maverick is already airborne. Within a few minutes, Maverick has the jet up to Mach 9, and the ground crew tells him he can come back down. But Maverick has other plans. He takes the jet up to Mach 10. He has saved the jobs of the flight crew, but now he's seeing what is possible with the aircraft. The flight crew tells him to back it off, but Maverick keeps pushing. When he gets it up to Mach 10.3, the jet starts vibrating wildly, then disintegrates. The screen is silent, with us seeing a distant shot of the plane's debris falling to Earth. Has our hero died? The movie just started. We do not see Maverick falling to Earth, maybe struggling to open his parachute, filled with terror. Instead, we see the astonished flight crew, including the general, hanging their heads at what they believe to be the end of Pete Maverick Mitchell. The next scene is of some cowboy diner, maybe in the Rocky Mountains, and Maverick stumbles in, dazed, wearing his flight jacket, soot on his face, his hair blown back like some fighter jock Einstein, and he asks, "Where am I?" The diners are startled by his appearance. None of them speak. Then one small boy pipes up, "Earth!" Incredibly cheesy, you might say. But there is brilliance to the story because it mirrors what we believe in the depths of our souls. Tom Cruise gives us a vision of how we want to one day present ourselves to God. I will fight to save those I love. I will fight next to realize great ambitions. And in the end, I will fight to be a completely unique individual. The globalists will never come up with such a compelling narrative because they don't believe in humanity. An inevitable consequence of the globalists believing they know how things should be done better than you do comes across loud and clear when they try to establish cooperation. Because they're not genuinely talking about cooperation. They're talking about submission to their will. Watch how Schwab tries first to push you into that panic stage before moving in for the kill. Truly shared values and well-established moral principles such as integrity, solidarity, and fairness are the glue that binds societies, enabling them to function and thrive in an atmosphere of trust. The magnitude of the issues we collectively face today, a deadly virus making us fear for our lives, the climate and environmental crisis, and the degradation of nature generating existential fear about the future, the speed of technological change provoking anxiety for our livelihoods and our way of life, often shifts our attitudes from altruistic to self-centered. This is the persuasion play. Make an appeal to widely accepted values such as integrity, solidarity, and fairness. Then pivot to the fear. COVID, climate change, environmental degradation, and the pace of technological change. The reader feels a little disoriented because they've been moved so quickly from a place of pleasure, considering the values of integrity, solidarity, and fairness, to fears of the future. And then, when they're in a vulnerable state, tell them they've gone from being altruistic to self-centered. It really is domestic abuse of the reader, and you might want to seek out a shelter for reader abuse victims. Schwab then moves into the savior role. Isn't it strange that for $5, Schwab has revealed nothing about himself? When politicians are trying to win our vote, don't they usually tell us every nauseating detail about themselves, like what their elementary school bus ride was like, or whether they may have bullied somebody in high school and live today in continual shame over the harm they may have inflicted decades ago? I believe it's a strategy. Schwab has made himself a blank slate, like movie stars used to do, before they thought it was a good idea to share everything about themselves. That's because he knows that if he talks about the failures of others, the conclusion readers will draw is that Schwab and his Davos buddies have none of those flaws. They're consciously assuming the mantle of the Ubermenschen, the supermen, who never share the slightest detail about themselves, which would make us connect with them as human beings. Today, this polarization is cleaving our liberal societies and is a key threat to their very survival. An effective response demands a reestablishment of trust, which in turn is only possible if political and business leaders exemplify the moral standards expected of them. Only by walking the value talk will they have the authority to implement essential value-oriented policies. I can't get over the fact that I've never once heard Schwab say his Davos buddies or government leaders need to talk to individual people. It's fine to talk to members of groups, but don't you learn so much more about people when you simply sit down and talk with them for a few hours? It's how human beings have solved problems for hundreds of thousands of years. Maybe our primitive ancestors, with no modern technology, had an exceptional advantage over us. If there was somebody within the tribe they disagreed with, they had to solve the problem. They couldn't just stalk off to their teepee and get on their iPhone to surf the Paleolithic web. People would notice unresolved conflicts, which might potentially threaten the ability of the tribe to survive in a brutal world that was often indifferent to their survival. As I've said before, the globalists have been using every world crisis from World War I to COVID-19 to push their agenda. Each crisis demands the same response they've been making for more than a century. Everything that comes in the post-pandemic era will lead us to rethink the role of government. Rather than simply fixing market failures when they arise, they should, as suggested by the economist Mariana Mazzucato, move towards actively shaping and creating markets that deliver sustainable and inclusive growth. They should also ensure that partnerships with businesses involving government funds are driven by public interest, not profit. Looking to the future, governments will most likely, but with different degrees of intensity, decide that it is in the best interest of society to rewrite some of the rules of the game and permanently increase their role. Bold added by author. Again, the globalists are not interested in having a conversation with you. That's because they're smarter than you. They get to decide what's in the best interest of society, which rules need to be rewritten, and which parts of their role will be permanently increased. And what is their goal? Schwab tells you. He thinks he has won, and yet there's never been a time in history in which the ruling powers have been more distrusted by their citizens. We are not at the end of this story. We are just at the beginning. They have operated by stealth so far, but they are coming out of the shadows. They believe they are strong. The truth is, they've never been more vulnerable. In the U.S., President Biden's Build Back Better bill, reduced to $1.8 trillion, places the Families Plan and climate measures at the centerpiece of his domestic agenda and represents a major stepping stone to create a more equitable and sustainable society. In Europe, the welfare state has a reputation of being the most extensive and generous in the world, but it might yet extend further. The level of protection varies by countries which administer welfare policies, but the European Commission has launched a new 750 billion euro COVID-19 recovery fund, comprising four pillars, two of which are destined to reduce social and territorial inequality and to boost economic cohesion. The globalists think they're winning, but if their ideas have been any good in the first place, they wouldn't have had to conceal them. And they still have their dissident problem, which is only going to get worse. Yes, they may kick us off their platforms, but we'll build new ones. If they demonetize us, we'll figure a way around that as well. Might they go so far as to kill some of us? They might. I don't discount that possibility. But each death would cost them precious capital, putting the lie to their claim of doing it for the public good. And despite all of their gun control measures, the fact is our side has most of the guns. The Second Amendment was not placed right after free speech because the Founding Fathers wanted to protect our right to hunt. The Second Amendment serves as a check on a government that might seek to become a tyranny. I understand these are scary times, but I am not afraid. I believe, as St. Augustine did, that the truth is like a lion. You don't have to defend it. Let it loose. It will defend itself. I have sought to set the truth free in this book, abundantly using the words of Klaus Schwab and his fellow globalists. The power is in your hands. However, in the final chapter of this book, I will review 10 areas to watch for globalist plans as God plans their ultimate defeat.